Hello, and welcome to episode 83 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
At its core, woke is a term that refers to being aware of social injustices and inequalities, particularly related to race and ethnicity. The word originated in African-American vernacular English in the 1940s, but it gained renewed popularity in the 2010s as a term used to describe a heightened awareness of understanding of systematic racism and social justice issues. However, the term has also become a source of controversy and debate, with some criticizing it for being overused and losing its original meaning, while others embrace it as a powerful tool for promoting social change. Rick, I think we both realize this week's topic is fraught with all sorts of ethical pitfalls, but I think it's important we both understand how each of us thinks about this term. So I'll start with this simple question. What does woke mean to you?
It is so hard to define this term because those on the left whom it's usually taken to apply don't want to own it. They want to say that like that's either an outdated or irrelevant or misappropriated term. For those on the right and maybe the center, I would say it seems to me to mean something like having a certain kind of self-righteous attitude towards issues of social justice. And as you mentioned, mainly related to race and gender. And also, it implies buying into kind of a highly abstract set of conceptions and terms that that are always changing, but express that kind of attitude.
And I think you're right in an extent that it is in its truest form, I guess, what you say. But I also think that Republicans especially have expanded the term so much to include so many things that just are at times make it indistinguishable from what I'd call traditional liberalism.
I think indistinguishable from progressivism, because you have to distinguish between classical liberalism, which I would say kind of many maybe left-leaning moderates, but even some, you know, right-leaning moderates would say they're classical liberals, but they don't hold to the kind of the new progressivism or what's sometimes called the new left. But I think you're right that critics of the left will often use woke to refer to a whole bunch of attitudes, including things like the New Green Deal.
Yeah, like yeah. And I think that can both help their argument sometimes, depending on who they're talking to, but also dilute the argument because it can mean so many different things.
Well, it becomes just a caricature
then
of an attitude rather than kind of pinpointing a certain kind of attitude. And it's hard. There is certainly a change in kind of younger progressives. They have a distinct set of ideas and commitments, things that they're passionate about, and it's important to identify those.
Trump talks so much about culture war issues and framed everything up around that people on his side of the equation looked at those issues and suddenly they became very important to them. And there were plenty of people who didn't like then President Trump who then looked at all these culture war issues he was bringing up and fought back equally as hard. And I don't want to say categorically that these issues aren't important. They are important and they should be discussed. But what worries me and sort of my take on this whole thing is that it just obscures some of the bigger issues that we should be talking about. I don't think for a minute, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, that these culture war issues should be front and center of our political discourse. But right now, in many ways, that seems to be it. Things like critical race theory, things like gender issues, all sorts of issues around race. Yes, these are important, but I almost kind of miss the days when we used to have debates between the parties about things like taxes and regulation and healthcare. And it seems like we've sort of set these issues aside in a lot of ways. And that got me thinking, well, why might this be? Yeah, people care about healthcare and taxes and regulation, but those are sort of complicated issues and do take a little bit of nuance. These culture war issues really aren't that. And if you want to make a splash with a hot take on social media, if you want to show up on a cable news channel on either side of the issue and get people, you know, all upset about a particular thing, these are the exact issues that you're going to bring people on to talk about. And I think with so much focus on this, it really is ignoring what I consider to be our country's bigger issues, bigger challenges, and I think that's just not a good thing.
It's not a good thing for several reasons. One of them is I think we have a fairly significant part of the population that is just ignoring the political discourse. And this is people who genuinely are concerned about things like economic policy and bank regulation and taxes and infrastructure, all the things, and maybe even education reform, things we used to talk about seriously.
And all things that government has a key role in.
Right. But since our politicians aren't addressing it, that they're then just tuning out the political dialogue because our politicians aren't taking them seriously. And so then why give them any attention? And so I think in some ways, as we've kind of discussed in this podcast over the last couple of years, we aren't paying a lot of attention to the political discourse in the issues we're choosing and talking about it because it's mainly irrelevant to the important issues facing society. And that's kind of a condemnation of our politics right now.
It is. But then at the same time, I mean, going back to the presidential debates of this last cycle, when you had all these Democrats lining up to run against Trump, there were like so much time spent, and I would argue wasted, about the idiosyncratic natures of each of the candidates' healthcare plans. And like, would you cover everybody or would you just expand Medicaid to 50 and older and all these things, which, I mean, I guess it's interesting, but none of this has even come close to being policy because there's no way that anything like that's going to get through Congress right now. And there's other things, you know, apparently, I guess, in most cases, Republicans and Democrats have come to an agreement that we're not going to cut Social Security benefits or Medicare right now because that seems to be settled. So part of me wonders that some of these big issues are just sort of like either on the too hard pile or we just kind of all agree on in some weird way. And so we have to find these culture war issues to plow all our attention into.
And I do think in some ways the culture war issues are really important, and yet we don't talk about them in a nuanced way. And the extreme voices who are, I would say, get the most representation in our media and social media especially, they are not talking about these issues in a nuanced way. And so we aren't actually making progress in how we shape our society. And you mentioned the Democratic primaries. You remember mm-hmm. the first televised debate when we had, I don't know, like 40 or 50 candidates all lined up in a row?
I'm sure I watched it. Yes.
Or maybe there was 12 or
yeah,
something.
There was
like
a lot. Yeah.
Like 12 or 15. There was a lot.
And some that had you knew had no chance.
But they didn't have time for discussion of mm-hmm. issues. And so they were just asked a number of questions, and then they had to raise their hand. Like yeah. It was,
who's in favor of this? And a hand would go up.
Yeah, but especially on issues like immigration. Now, here's a, on the one hand, this is a really complex kind of economic issue, economic and social issue. But the attitudes that were being expressed were purely along the culture war lines. Like, are you for or against? It was... And this is what worries me about the kind of culture war debates that this term wokeism has now become a part of, is that people are taking really firm positions on things without, first of all, really understanding what the issues are, and even not, I think, really not caring too much.
Well, I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, that you think these issues, maybe we're talking about them the wrong way, but are more important than I might think. So I want you to make that pitch to me.
Well, we're in the midst of a pretty radical transformation in social norms. I think social norms are vitally important because they're the ways in which we provide structure for people to get along and provide parameters for how we carry out, say, disagreements on things. And so that's really important for issues like trust and collaboration and negotiation. Social norms are vital to all those things which make society work. So we're in the midst of a pretty rapid shift in what our social norms are, but we're doing it by casting anybody who disagrees with us as an enemy. And this is going to be really bad because we're playing around with norms, we're shifting to new ones, but we're doing it in a way that's in which we're not bringing the whole society along, or even a, you know, I think a sizable majority. We're just dividing into camps. And I worry about this because, well, there's many reasons. I think, like, we could make some huge mistakes. For one thing, many social norms develop over centuries as we learn from human experience, like what works and what doesn't for different forms of life. The other thing is you need a certain amount of consensus in society about major things so that you can have disagreement about the other things. And if you disagree about everything, you have no way of kind of prioritizing. Well, like, and I would say kind of negotiating in ways that we can win as a society. And we can see right now how this is tearing schools apart.
But I don't disagree with anything you said. But here's where I see the problem is that, you know, if we're not going to do a podcast today about failing banks. But if we were, we would have deep discussions about fiscal policy, monetary policy, all sorts of ways the government can, what it can do and not do to prop up banks.
Yeah.
That's all. And we all know how that, well, you can learn if you don't know, but we can, there are ways that works and the government has a key role to play in that. I don't know though, in everything you just said, what role the government has there. I mean, what if you, and I know you never would, but if you ran for president and got elected, you can't pass a bill to make people do those things, can you? I mean, how, is it just setting a different tone? Or are there levers the government has to make things like that you describe better?
Well, I mean, this is why the social norms are so important. I mean, everything that the government does as far as policies and regulation all operate within a context of wider norms that kind of govern our behavior, or at least our expectations of one another's behavior. And we can't have government kind of dictating that behavior, you know, down to every action. This is the problem, by the way, with what many Republican governors are doing right now with laws regarding teaching of theories about gender and critical race theory in schools. I mean, what is being taught in many schools is a product of conversations that have been taking place in society for a very long time. I think some of the ideas that are being taught are pretty good, and some of them are pretty bad and require more evaluation. But you're not going to effectively shape what children are taught by these kinds of policies that say, like, these words can be used and those words can't. I mean, it's just a disastrous way of going about education because it doesn't work that way. Because for one thing, you have teachers in relationship with kids and you have kids in relationship with one another. And the government can pass all the regulations it wants. People are going to have conversations outside of that. And so if you want to reform what we teach in schools, you do it from an ongoing discussion about what's important and what do we agree on that's important and should be taught. And so that's why, like, the talk about social norms is vitally important. And we're going about it all the wrong way by having our politicians engaging in these kind of vitriolic disagreements with one another and then end up taking sides on these kind of high level and abstract political positions, but we're not having actual discussions about, like, what do we really want our kids to be taught?
So I think what you're saying is that this is truly more of a leadership issue than a policy issue.
We should take policy out of a lot of this, right? But we should be we should be taking the discussion of ideas very seriously. So like whatever woke is, like one of the ideas that's kind of central to progressivism right now is that just about anything about our identity is socially constructed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's an important idea. And that's like, that's a big shift. Okay. And this, you know, this comes out of kind of some postmodernist theories and some other kind of American academics working mainly in the 1970s and 80s. And you have ideas being presented that are very interesting. There's much about our identities that is socially constructed. There's quite a bit that isn't or that probably isn't. And there's quite a bit that's up for question. This needs to be talked about. And politicians are not good at talking about that. They're good about what, you know, at slogans, right? At labeling and slogans and
getting
blaming
elected.
And getting elected. Yeah. But and you're not going to further the conversations and a deeper understanding, especially where I am at universities, by saying, you know, like, well, if you're a state university that's getting funded by, you know, by our state budget, you can't talk about these theories or these ideas. That's really a dumb way of going about trying to improve things and get greater clarity on what these issues are.
And I'm sure I'm in the minority here, but if like the government ran the way I would like it to, it's more, I guess, a technocratic view that you have like problems and you create policy prescriptions to try to solve these problems, and then you measure to see if it did the change in regulation or law did what you think it did, and if it did, great. If not, recalibrate, and just have sort of this very machine approach to it, an engineering approach, I guess, where you have a problem, you have a solution, you try to influence public policy. And all the other stuff that you're talking about, in my mind, is just not something that government should meddle in at all. And I'm not saying that it's not a problem, but to me, it's just beyond their scope of what they should focus on. I think you would say that's not how you feel.
This is a really hard thing to answer because in some ways, I think, like, I wish we could do that. I wish we had the kind of social context in which that was possible. There was a slogan that became popular in the late 80s, early 90s, the personal is political. And it was kind of a slogan at that time. I think for many, especially younger people right now, it's a fact. It's just the way it is. And so the kind of segregating politics off for these kind of technocratic, solution-oriented discussions that are mainly based on objective data, they just see that as impossible because objective data is also a kind of social construct that reflects the concerns arising out of one's identity. And so you'll always bring the personal into those discussions. And I think that's where the rub is. So like, how do you determine, like even determining that, so these kinds of discussions are walled off from the subjective, and that's what government should be concerned with.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you would want to say, like this part can be walled off, there'd be people that want to challenge it and say, no, that's a reflection of like how you were raised and how you see things based on your identity lens.
And that could well be, and that I suppose would make me not woke?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good indication.
But I mean, right. At the same time, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've never been asked the question. I guess if I consider myself woke, I probably don't. But but at the same time, when I've had discussions around the issue, my position is usually that, again, focusing on things like race and gender, especially, yeah, maybe the people who are full woke are probably a little too far for where I would be. However, if you go back 50 years and see how we dealt with some of those issues back then, I would much rather be erring a little on the side of being too careful than just not caring one little bit. So that's why I'm not especially bothered by it, because it's probably a little bit of an overcorrection, but geez, it seems a whole lot better than where we used to be.
You mean as far as kind of general social attitudes?
Yeah, like, I mean, I'm generalizing a lot here, but I think in the 1960s, which is more than 50 years ago, I guess now, but like a lot of people were racist. And like, I mean, not only in their actions, but I mean, if you could like magically get in the brains of people and how they were thinking back then, I think you would be like really surprised about how the attitudes people had back then. And naturally, those attitudes were reflective on how people were treated. And I mean, and you look at not only people of color, but how women were treated in the workplace and certainly gays and lesbians and all sorts of marginalized groups were treated really poorly back then. Absolutely, things are better now. Absolutely, things could be better. But I would feel that the woke overreach, if that's what it is just so much better than where it was in the early 1960s.
Yeah, I have mixed thoughts about that. I mean, I think as far as kind of general attitudes towards people who we would say have been kind of historically marginalized, and so here, even using terms kind of identifies where you stand on this scale, right? I would say that, yeah, we made a lot of progress in those areas. But then if you look at like where attitudes are shifting, and if the shifting towards the more kind of woke, or I don't like the term, more progressive.
It's the topic of today's show,
I know,
Rick.
It is a topic, and I don't like, well, it's hard to like a term in which anyone you want to say is woke is somebody who rejects the term,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Like that's makes it problematic.
Yeah.
But if we say like towards some more, the new liberal or the more progressive side of the spectrum, you have pretty strong attitudes that like everything in our society now that we've kind of inherited, especially our institutions, are the product of colonialism and kind of oppressive patriarchic structures. And that principally goes towards things like capitalism and democracy. And if you say, okay, well, if that's what it is, it's like this viewing everything through a lens in which everything we have, like all culture is a product of these battles between about power, and the oppressors always win out. And so whatever we've inherited is a result of oppression, and our task is to overturn it. So then our task is to overturn kind of everything established that we've inherited. Well, that's pretty dangerous, because when you're actually successful at overturning a lot of existing structures, is you don't get liberation for the people who are most oppressed. You get chaos for the people who are most oppressed. It's the people who are the best off in society that are most able to weather kind of uncertainty and chaos in our society. Because for one thing, they can move around.
Yeah, they can wall themselves off from it.
Right. And so these are really dangerous ideas to be playing around with. And I see a real strong tendency to accept those ideas and even like, so that's been in the news quite a bit, the protest at Stanford Law School.
Yes.
Right? So this is taken, especially on the right, as an example. You know, a whole bunch of law students at one of the nation's best law schools shouting obscenities at a conservative judge who was invited to the campus to speak.
By a student group.
And many more students who are protesting and protesting very loudly, preventing the judge from speaking, many more protesting than were planning to be present to listen to him in the first place. That sort of thing is a really dangerous precedent, because then you ask, well, in any society, especially a democracy where we're a pluralistic society, you have a lot of different ideas and a lot of ideas in which, like, depending on what we decide to do, you have people with competing and sometimes conflicting interests. There's going to be winners and losers. So is the answer that, like, whoever shouts loudest wins, like whoever can gather the biggest crowd? I mean, this is a majoritarian view. And that's a recipe for oppression. It's a recipe for greater oppression, not a release from oppression. And so I find it to be like, if you take these ideas and take them seriously, they're counterproductive.
Yeah, and the Stanford thing, we'll go down that way for a bit, but many things bothered me about that. One of the things that bothered me, though, is that, like you said correctly, this was at the law school. And these are, and Stanford's not some third-rate school. These should be, and probably are, smart kids who are going into an adversarial role in our legal system. And you would think that they would be able to use that as a chance to intelligently engage with this speaker and ask him, I think it was him?
Yeah.
Ask him good questions that maybe intellectually trip him up and have that. And they should welcome that exchange because that should be exactly what would be good practice for them for their line of work. So that I don't get. But secondly, it seems to me that if there's a conservative group of students on Stanford that invited the speaker, I think we can probably guess that this conservative group of law students on Stanford is probably a pretty small group. I think that's a likely true statement.
It was the Federalist Society.
The Federalist Society, yeah.
It's a small group.
It's a small group. So, you know, part of me wonders why they, you know, the reaction could it have been, well, there's this guy coming to speak, and he's speaking to a small group of likely like-minded students. And wouldn't the best thing here to be just sort of ignore that, not draw attention to that, and the next day, 8 or 12 or 15 people sat in a small room with him, got to hear what he had to say, and life moved on, instead of like making such a big deal about this? Sometimes like shrugging things off like that might have been a much better approach.
If you think you are in a position to kind of say win in the long run for your side by taking that approach, you would do that. But if you feel yourself to be beleaguered, so that like on this campus you are in the majority, but in the culture as a whole, you're in the minority, and the conservative justices have the upper hand and are instituting these oppressive ideas that are really harmful for the people that you feel compassion for, then you want to show the world just how oppressive and bad these ideas are, and you do that by protesting.
But heckling and yelling down. I mean, that's...
Once you unleash these kinds of emotions, it's hard to stay in check. This is the problem with what's happened in our politics. When we have a politics of taking sides, you stop. You don't see any point in civility anymore because it's all about winning rather than convincing.
But you're saying, again, neither of us were in the room, but from what we've read, that there was a group of people who showed up to this event who were, before they got there, even angry and motivated by a bunch of grievances about what this person had said in the past and wanted to take out their emotional response in a very public way. Is that a fair summation of it?
Yeah.
About
him, about what conservative justices in general. So this is in some ways a protest against people, you know, like Kavanaugh as well.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. But I guess the point I was trying to make is that is in many ways the same mindset that comes to former President Trump when he holds a rally and gets all of his people together who are very upset about certain things in society that they feel have harmed them. And they just stand there and shout and yell a bunch of things that don't necessarily fix anything, but just make sure they're the loudest voices in that room. Is that a bad parallel or an improper parallel to draw?
No, I think it's correct. I think we have two. The people are most extreme on both the left and the right. Both feel themselves to, sincerely to be aggrieved, to be the victims in the culture wars, and that they're in the losing ends, and that justifies their tactics. And so tactics that to many of us will seem quite unreasonable appear reasonable to them because so much is at stake and they're losing.
So tell me why this theory is wrong, and maybe it's not, is that you have people on, I'll say, the far right and in kind of MAGA world who base their existence on make America great again, meaning that America was once a much better place. It has not. Often these are around issues around race and other culture war things, but they want to go back to when they think America was somehow better and that the trajectory we're on, they would say, is a dangerous one. At the same time, you have people on the far left who often refer to this moment in time as a late capitalistic hellscape, that they are extremely unhappy with the trajectory of our nation, that they see all these negative things happening and see very little hope in changing that curve and are just very pessimistic about the future. So you have this happening on both sides. Is there not, however, a place in a pretty wide middle there for someone, a leader, to show up and say, you know what? I think we're actually have a really optimistic future. And yeah, we have problems and we should try to fix those problems. But I don't believe for a second that the past was somehow better than what we're not only at today, but the potential we have tomorrow. It just seems like that optimistic message is just out there. Because I think that's really where most Americans are. And I just don't, and I mean, I guess Biden likes to say things like he's convinced there's, I think, something to the effect of there's nothing that Americans can't do if they don't put their mind to it, or something that's, you know, relatively optimistic. But it just seems like, and maybe that's why Obama was so popular back when he first ran, is he sort of had that combination of we need to fix things, but do so in a positive and forward-looking way. And maybe even Reagan too. But it just doesn't seem like we have that character out there now. And geez, it seems like there's such an opportunity.
Yeah, for the most part, I think you're right. There is, I mean, there's a lot of people who would agree with you. I don't know if there's still the opportunity for that kind of leader to come forth. You know, a year or two ago, I would have said yes. I'm wondering if the landscape has shifted a little bit too much for that to happen.
Meaning those left, far left and far right groups have grown so large and so influential?
Yeah, even though I think the loud voices are still minorities within each party. The voices are so loud, they're driving more and more people from the center to one of those two extremes. And especially, we hear more and more reports, especially from our college campuses that are, I would say, the some of our most elite and most liberal institutions from which many of our society's leaders are going to come over the next couple of decades. They're the ones who are participating in the kinds of protests that we would have never seen on those campuses 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that's a bad sign, because this is where you want the leaders developing. You want them at that time in their lives while they're on campus to be reflecting more in I think a more nuanced way. And I don't think they're being exposed to that.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't around in the 60s, but I mean, from everything I've read, the 60s had a protest or two on a college campus or two. And that was the baby boomers primarily.
Yeah, now you're reassuring me. And now, you might be right.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, the baby boomers made a real quick pivot from peace and love to 401ks.
Yep, that's right. And that makes me more optimistic. And also, you know, like when I'm teaching my classes, most students really aren't interested in the culture wars very much. I find it, and I'm glad they aren't. There are a number of students on every campus that are really interested in these topics, but I find that in my classes, there'll be a couple of them, but then the rest of them are just interested in learning. They're interested in their future. they're interested in, and many times, like, finding out ways to be a good contributing citizen in their society. So maybe we should be more optimistic.
Well, before we close, I wanted to bring up a letter you received from someone who read a recent column of yours that is a bit related to today's topic. The column was about why so many teens feel so anxious. There's certainly data to support that it's probably at an all-time high in America right now. And I'll let you talk a little bit about what your column was about and what the letter writer's comment was.
Well, my column was actually the same thing we talked about a couple weeks ago in our podcast. This some of the reporting that's been done on the causes of teen anxiety and teen depression, how it you know took a strong upward shift in 2011, has been increasing ever since. And speculation by different writers that this is either due to social media use and smartphones, and there's pretty strong evidence that it's related to that. And the other is a fairly recent finding that students who identify as liberal tend to have more depression or depressive affect than students who identify as conservative.
And this letter writer took issue with that last point especially, I think.
Yeah, and took issue with me highlighting that and thought that, like, a better explanation would be the fact that so many conservative politicians are implementing policies and using language that is really discriminatory, especially to students who identify as LGBTQ. I think there is, I mean, when you hear some of the language that is going on and you see some of the legislation that's being passed in states like Florida and Texas, I understand where that writer is coming from. And yet these kinds of reactions have been happening mostly since 2020. The conservative reaction to the culture wars is pretty late in the game. It wasn't going on 2009, 2010, 11, and 12. And that's where we see that real rise in depressive affect and anxiety. And so I think we were right, basically.
Well, and I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but I wanted to just, as you were saying that, it made me think of something, is that Tennessee was in the news maybe a month or so ago, that they passed, I think at the time, and maybe still is, the nation's most restrictive law when it comes to drag performances in children. And I mean, my own position on this is I'm not even sure that is exactly constitutional. I mean, to me, I mean, you know, movie theaters choose, not by law, but just because they choose to not let kids into R-rated films. But we all know kids see R-rated films, and some of R-rated films are pretty R-rated. And I don't think that's even close to what goes on at any drag show that's going on out there. So I think it's an issue, but it certainly has whipped up a lot of anger among some parts of, especially on the left. And again, I think it's a silly law. It may not even be constitutional. But here's where I wanted to bring it up is, I think it was maybe 10 years earlier. I don't have the exact timing, but it doesn't really matter. But in the recent past, Tennessee passed a law that made community college free to all high school graduates from Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I don't think many states have that. And I think that's a pretty good thing. And I, you know, if I had a 15-year-old in Tennessee, would I be thrilled with the drag show prohibition law? No, but again, that's sort of nonsense, and that affects so few people. But nobody ever talks about, like, how if more states did what Tennessee did, and more states made community college free or much, much cheaper to especially address some of the workforce challenges we have around the trades. I mean, that would make a huge difference. And I guess my point of bringing this up, and it kind of goes back to what I said at the beginning, those are the policies that we should be talking a whole lot more about. Because if I had a 15-year-old, I would care so much more about that kid getting the chance of a free community college education than maybe not being able to go to a drag show.
Absolutely. I agree with you completely. And that's why I have a hard time getting too worked up over some of these laws that are being passed. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they go way overboard, and I think that some of them are probably not even constitutional. However, there's more important things to talk about. So I agree with you on that. And I think making education more readily available. And I think looking very closely at how we're doing our education, like there's some really good evidence that our children are not reading nearly as much as they used to. So what are we doing wrong in how we're teaching reading? I think we've made some big mistakes in kind of educational priorities and you know, assessment, how we assess progress in math and reading and things like this. I think we've made some big mistakes. We're not talking about these things nearly enough, and we're getting too distracted by the culture wars.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. And I guess maybe neither of us is very woke.
I think that's a pretty good indication that we're not very woke. First of all, we're not woke if we don't seriously object to the term. and then we also don't think it's all that important to begin with. So there's two strikes against us.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, what is your question for me?
Okay, Scott, let's say that while at work, you notice repeated incidents that you regard as sexual harassment of one coworker by another. What you observe is mostly inappropriate and sexually suggestive language, jokes, comments about appearance, and things like that. So one day you talk to the person who's been the target of that behavior, and they tell you they do not like it but don't want to report this other person. They tell you that they don't want to rock the boat. Do you have an obligation to report it anyway?
And the only I'm only want to clarify one point before answering. This isn't something I heard about or got third hand. This is something I saw myself, correct?
Yeah, and something you see on a regular basis.
Okay, so
So this isn't terrible behavior,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems wrong. It seems inappropriate to
you. Yeah, I mean, I think, and that is the benefit, I think, of working for a little bit larger corporation. I mean, this is where I feel I would report it as the direct answer. I feel bad for people who work where this is going on. And it's a company of like four people. And like maybe the boss is doing this or the boss's like kid who's like in charge is doing this and they have nowhere to turn. And that's where it gets really uncomfortable. But in a case where you are with a larger company, hopefully most companies, most publicly traded companies especially, care about things like this, that I think, you may have to do a little bit of maybe take some notes just to say, you know, Tuesday at 4 p.m., here's what I heard. But I would have no hesitation to go and talk to the HR department about such things. So that's a pretty easy call for me. I do have a follow-up question if I can.
Could I do a follow-up
please?
First?
Yeah, please, yes.
So what if... So I, in the situation I proposed to you, the person I said who was kind of the targeted behavior didn't like it, but mm-hmm. they didn't want to rock the boat. So then you might think, well, you could actually help them out if you reported it because they're not really involved in rocking the boat. You know, there shouldn't be any repercussion on them. But what if they think it's fine? In fact, they joke back. They think it's all fine. But do you think this is inappropriate? It's not directed at you. It doesn't make your environment worse, but you just don't think it's appropriate.
If, and I can't imagine this is the case, if somehow it is just the three of us who work together in this very contained group, and one's making the comments, the other person's receiving the comments, thinks it's funny and kind of jokes back, and I'm the third person there who's just sort of not involved in the conversation but thinks it's mildly inappropriate, I mean, possibly I would just say, well, that's the dynamic of this small group. The much more common situation, though, is that this, even though it may just be between these two people, this is overheard in the office among other people. Other people know what's going on. And then there's sort of the question about, well, if this guy can get away with it, you know, who else can get away with it? And why isn't the company doing anything? And the company says they don't like this kind of thing, but the company's not doing anything when it's going on. So I just think, I unless it is just somehow magically contained to just those two people, I think it just sets a really bad example for the company and kind of gives permission in a way to for others to behave the same way.
What were you going to follow up with?
Well, okay, so, and the reason, and it's funny a little bit because although I do work for a large company, I do work remotely from home. I mean, I the only time I come into an office at all is when the two of us record this podcast. So, and I'm not faulting my company for this, but I do get, oh, maybe once a year, a polite email from our HR department that I need to watch the video about how to react to exactly like scenarios like you outlined. And of course, I'm thinking, well, I guess this could happen on a Zoom call, although that's not one of the examples that was in the video I watched. But it does seem funny that in a way that remote employees probably deal with this less, I would suppose. But I watched the video, and I'm sure it was not produced by our company. It's sort of an off-the-shelf one that they buy from companies that specialize in this sort of thing. And I guess the question is, I'm sure, have you watched some of these videos? Whether it's the same one, of course, we'll never know. But do you, I guess the question is, this was still fresh in my mind. I think I watched this maybe in February. And so I like, oh, I know what to do. And I think I knew what to do before, but it was like really top of mind. Do you find those sort of sit down and watch this video and then respond to a couple question things effective to spread the word among employees out there, or is there a better way to do it?
Yeah, there's a much better way to do it. I think that they're incredibly ineffective, and actually we have good data to show that those kinds of training videos just don't work.
Really?
Yeah, well, because so two things. One is they're heavily legalized language. So, you know, you get government laws, you know, with several clauses of what are the conditions. And this is a terrible way to learn that sort of thing, where you have all these, you know, statements of what the law is, and then you have a multiple choice question. And if you don't pick the right one, then you have to go back and watch it again, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's just short-term memory. And it's short-term memory about whether you can remember certain phrases in their context, but they're not testing, do you understand how it actually works?
I mean, all these are probably different, but I thought ours were actually fairly decent. How it was set up is like, it starts off by saying, today you're going to learn about this topic, and it's going to be based on this workplace. And they introduce like four or five characters in the work, like here's, you know, here's Cindy and she's the boss, and then reporting to Cindy is this person and these people are on a team and whatever, and kind of sets up the hierarchical structure. And then after that, you watch like three or four scenes between two or three of the characters. And then you're like asked, like, you know, and so like a situation like you outline comes up, and then it's like, what should Fred do? And then you're like, well, he should do this, this, or this. And then you get to choose the one. And usually it's pretty straightforward. But I mean, I guess I found that format to be like slightly more engaging than the one you describe.
Yeah, the one I described was highly technical, lots of legal language, and there's all kinds of actual questions. In real situations, questions come up where you could question the appropriateness of certain kinds of responses based on the legal language, but you don't have an opportunity in replying in a multiple choice answer. So then what you do is you give the answer which you think the computer or whoever designed the computer test wants you to give, instead of thinking more deeply about the subject. I see that's where like you can have some real training, is where you actually talk about various scenarios and then say, well, what are the options here, and actually work through them. Because, I mean, it's complicated depending on, you know, like what somebody says or like what images they show. You know, if you're in a parking lot, you're walking across the parking lot, and there's two people talking, and you're a third person who kind of joins them as you're all going to the building, and in one of them, one person shows another a image of a naked person on the phone, and they're laughing at somebody they know. Well, is it somebody in the company? Is it one of them? And you're not really sure. You know, what do you do about that? Do you report it or not? Well, a lot of it has to do with what is their relationship? What, like, who is it that they're talking about? You know, there's, and that isn't easily answered by the legal language.
Yeah.
And so I find those training programs to be too abstract and general to actually apply to the difficult cases where it's hard to know what to do.
The one I remember, and I forget the exact details, and this was a little outside of like the sexual harassment section, but it was this kind of guy says, you know, your coworker Bob is really into, I think it was Dungeons and Dragons, and he starts showing up wearing a cloak and talking in an old English accent, and like, is this something you should report, or is Bob just being a goofy guy? And the reaction, and the proper answer was, Bob's just kind of goofy and that's okay. But it kind of made me laugh that they kind of, and they showed this guy show up to work who looked kind of ridiculous. But I think the point was to say, well, being ridiculous is probably fine as long as you can still do your work.
Boy, that's so fascinating, because I was just talking to a teacher the other day who said he had a substitute teacher showed up dressed like that.
Really?
And that made him question, like, yeah, that's goofy, but I also question this person's fitness to be subbing in a classroom for me.
I think in this example, it was just sort of like some entry-level clerical job, so it was probably okay.
Yeah, rather than like being responsible for a bunch of sixth graders or something.
Yeah, I think I'll choose the clerical job every time in that case. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify, and be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.